Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world, by Anne Morrell. Now, this is a reading for a book, and I'm trying to phone the publisher to get permission to podcast. Anne Morrell, it's A-A-N-N-M-O-Y-A-L, is a sort of super, she's an AR92, she's a super Australian historian who's founded something called the Independent Scholars Association of Australia. And she's in Canberra. And she herself is a pretty remarkable person. Order of Australia. What's happened is I've gone through the library, picked up various books. In general, self-help books by Americans. I just, you know, just can't read. And this is an odd book, Platypus. I thought it would be nothing, you know, just interesting. But it's extremely detailed, and it describes this, the platypus, which we'll talk a bit about later. It's a very odd Australian animal. It's not odd because it's here in Australia and it works quite well. It's sort of a cross between a beaver and a duck. It's a poisonous claw, and it's got a electromagnetic sensor on its bill to help it guide, and it lays eggs. So how? And it's got the softest fur of any animal, I believe, on Earth. So that made it, of course, very much hunted by our able European friends. I like the idea because it's an animal which just doesn't fit in to scientific concepts, and so therefore initially it got a real bad hiding. And also Anne herself looks to have established a club for academics who just don't fit into the mould, and so I'll read from it, and I'll continue to try and get in contact with the publishers, which are Alan Irwin, and I'll try and contact them again. It's published in 2001, but Anne, incredibly, is still with us. Not with us. It's a bad thing. She's just still chugging away. Her societies are going well, with a chapter in every state of Australia. So this, I sort of really like that, because Australia, in terms of the bandwidth of academic thought and commercial activity, is sort of very limited. The money comes in and it's distributed sort of basically about the state, the size of California, less than that, the size population of Texas, and so distributed with just uncountable universities, small campuses. So there's probably 5 universities in Melbourne and Sydney, and 3 or 4 in the other capitals. You know, you probably get 100 universities in Australia. Oh, not 100, probably in the 70s of universities. And so the money is very tight, and it comes from one direction, and there's a long way from markets to the commercial stuff there. The military isn't there. The small military research. So it's a very inward looking, little academic community. And it's very interesting that we have evolved the Anne Morrell organism, which is this Independent Scholars Association of Australia, the ISAA, which I've tried to find out about. And I'm sure I'll be ignored when I'm in a different section. Now, there's a few quotes here by A.B. Banjo Patterson, who's a famous sort of iconic Australian poet, in a poem or part from The Animals That Noah Forgot. And the world's, quote, the world's great story is left untold, and the message is left unsaid. And from B.R. Stone, and The Incomplete Book of Australian Mammals, the platypus, the first ornithorhynchus, confused early thinkers. They said, oh good lord, it's an obvious fraud. Somebody has stuck the front end of a duck with the skill of a weaver to the part of a beaver. It's no less a fake than the mermaids they make from a fish and an ape, a ridiculous jape. We all know it's real, though I can't help but feel that its tail, from tail tip to muzzle, is still a puzzle. Here. And what's amazing is the way that this is put together. It's just incredibly well written book, even though it's about an animal, about a platypus, and it's not a self-help book. However, it's sort of code for self-help. I like it. Acknowledgements. A number of people have given most valuable assistance for the writing of this book. The Patrick Room of the National Library of Australia has been my hearth, and there I've enjoyed and benefited from the help of welcoming staff. And I can't tell you, the librarians are just the end. They're just they're great. Anything you're studying, you can put it on a request, and they have to get back to you in 10 years. In 10 days' time. And they're well considered research. The following colleagues and friends have given me timely encouragement and information. Bill Gamage, Bill Byrne with Aboriginal Legends, El Fisk of the Hillfields Sanctuary, Peter Glow, Jamie McKenzie, the late Elizabeth Newland, Prosky, Nancy Sower, Chris Tinneman, and Jeff Williams of the Australian Platypus Conservancy. So Hillsville is a sort of park at the back of Melbourne, and it's a famous platypus breeding station. When we went there before they bred it, they had this really complicated set of warrens, which you could see from the outside. They were constructed of PVC, sort of fairly large PVC pipes, but there were pink and blue ones for the male and the female to walk between the different warrens to visit each other inside. I'm especially grateful to my editors, Colette Vella, Karen Ward and Simone Ford, and to my publisher, Ian Browning, for their creative and skillful interest and assistance. I also acknowledge the sense of Rowan Strathern's permission to quote his poem, The Ornithobichus, published in the Incomplete Book of Australian Mammals, Kangaroo Press, 1987. The Australian Stockman's Hall of Fame, Longreach, Queensland, for the Harry Bustle's poem, The Mud-Sucking Platypus, and the John Curtin Prime Ministerial Library, Curtin University of Technology, Perth, and for H.V. Evatt's Cablegram to Canberra of May 1943, whatever that is. I'm always with permission to use copyright pictorial material in possession of the library's publishers or individuals is made in illustrations near the end of the book. Canberra 2000. Introduction. Few people have seen the platypus in the wild. I had not. Writing about its history, I knew I must see the legendary animal in its natural environment. One winter afternoon, at the invitation of the director of the Australian Platypus Conservancy of Victoria, I set off on a long drive to Healesville and Whittlesea. My journey took me along dappled, tree-fringed country roads, as labyrinth as it seems as the platypus burrow itself, until afternoon light deepened into early twilight and I came to the appointed reservoir, grey-blue below the mountains. You can't say it. Platypus warrens are a labyrinth, especially when you see these artificial ones they build. And there, on the water's rim, where the roots thicken and overarching gum trees dipped, a small brown head appeared gliding the body, as one 19th century observer put it, flat as a plank in the water. Its presence confirmed by the circle of light concentric ripples in the stream. I'd seen a platypus, not as one sometimes sees them, diving fritfully in the aquatic tank at the zoo, but in its peaceful native habitat, cruising quietly in pursuit of its evening meal. After so long a torturous drive, magic. The platypus has become an Australian icon, its small furry frame pressed into thousands of commercial replicas and cast on the back of 20-cent coins, its sleek, unmistakable form serving as company logos and a cheerful Australian Olympic symbol. Has become recalled by nostalgic expatriates around the world. And one of the interesting things is that if a foreigner sees a platypus in a book, they don't know what it is, because they've got beavers, deers and stuff like that. They know kangaroos, koalas, they don't know platypus. Some of us know that this small aquatic animal, which, unlike any other living animals, excepting the fellow monotreme, the echidna, lays eggs. Now, what I want to say is monotreme means a single track, so it doesn't have, what you call a vagina or something like that. It's like a cloa, like a bird. It does lay a egg. And also the echidna lays eggs. These are equivalent of our hedgehogs, sort of like massive hedgehogs, but they're much cuter, and I think they're much cuter, and they're weirder, you know, infinitely weirder, a strange variable body temperature. Hopefully I'll find out all about this. In April 1999, the story of the birth of captivity of two platypuses at Healesville Sanctuary outside Melbourne caught the attention of the media of the world. 55 years after the first captive birth of this enigmatic animal, a second success had been achieved. One very small male platypus emerged from the artificial burrow to be followed amid surprise and jubilation 1 week later by a second healthy platypus, another boy. Which is interesting, this artificial burrow, I think when we visited it more recently, they've got rid of it, but it's just incredible to see at the back. In a few short weeks, the event reignited the intense interest that the platypus had evoked following its first appearance in Britain as a dry specimen at the end of the 18th century. When the first specimen reached England in 1799, with its webbed feet, fur, bill like a duck seemingly stitched onto its body, the platypus was regarded as a hoax, a high frolic practiced on the scientific community by some colonial prankster. After examining it carefully, dubious naturalists declared it to be real, an animal that lived and breathed, but the platypus continued to confound international biologists for nearly 90 years. I have to comment about how brilliantly this is written. It's such a brilliantly written book. Above all, the nature of its reproductive process remained a mystery. This mystery was crucial, for the late 18th and 19th century saw zoologists, botanists, systematists, and theoreticians in scientific centres in Britain and Europe keenly concerned with the ongoing task of refining the classification system of animals in the plant kingdoms. It was a task and a challenge that multiplied as new genera and species, and at times new orders and classes were brought into light by the exploration of the new world. Taxonomy and systematics, the identification and classification of plants and animals, had their roots in classical times. A key handful of 17th and 18th century scholars from Britain and the continent had made a distinctive contribution. But it was the 19th century that was destined to become the great century of classification and decoding of the complex and diversifying book of nature. In this task, the continent of Australia, with its unique fauna, and in a hemisphere far distant from the centres of Western research, had a vital part to play and had become a major outpost of information for an important contributor to the theory of evolution. In the 20th century, research on the platypus would shift to Australia itself, where, across another 100 years or more, the animal was to continue to dazzle surprise biologists. It became, as the distinguished researcher inscribed it, the animal of all time. And this is its story. What a beautiful writing. What a beautiful classic writing. So you pick this book up and you think, oh, it's going to be nothing. It's a great book. This highly interesting novelty. This is chapter one. No country ever produced a more extraordinary assemblage of indigenous productions. P.P. King, narrative of a survey of intertropical waters and western coast of Australia, performed between 1888 and 1822. The river is very still on the curve where the eucalyptus dips towards the water. The light shades towards late afternoon, and the Tyrant would soon darken the outline of a wooded bank and a flat landscape stretching towards the horizon. Bubbles break the surface of the water. A small brown head, its sleek cap visible for no more than 2 centimetres, glides silently in the river's flow. Silent, intent on its evening search for food, this is the platypus, a timid, secretive, highly improbable creature that was to baffle the scientific world for over 90 years. Cast Britain and Europe's leading zoologists into a whirl of fierce dispute and become a key, if unexpected, player in the great theoretical philosophical debates that were to transform our understanding of the animal kingdom and usher in a new century of biological science. Liz is such a writer. Look at her. Neither fish nor fowl, bird nor reptile, the platypus, it seemed, came out of this antipedian ark with its webbed feet, duck-like bill, densely glossy fur, a high-placed, brightly bee eyes, and a small body shaped for swift propulsion through the river lagoon. A living fossil turned up in the distant southern reaches of the globe. Ever since the expedition of exploration launched in the 16th century, adventurous men have brought back from the New World lands exotic creatures that startled the gaze and challenged the understanding of Europeans. Marsupial opossums, as early as 1500, and later the giraffe, hippopotamus, armadillo, and the sloth proved eccentric wonders, defying the naturalists who believed that the Garden of Eden they knew was already full, and dazzling public through pictorial representations or through stuffed and living specimens in museums or zoos. It was, however, the Endeavour voyage of Captain Cook, dispatched by the British Academy in 1768 to observe the transit of Venus at Tahiti to locate the removed Great Southern Land, that, with a multitude of specimens assembled by Joseph Banks, took scientific collection of fauna and flora to a new level. Previously unknown, worlds of zoological and botanical species were now thrown open to European view, beginning transformation in scientific understanding of the natural world. Cruising along the eastern coast of Australia in 1770 and located 6 weeks north of Queensland's Endeavour River, Banks and a Swedish colleague, Carl Solander, who died eventually, I think, had a good opportunity to observe the old flora and fauna that were to brand Australia as an upside-down world of reverses and differences where all seemed queer and opposite. Quote, it was they who introduced its rarity to the scientific world. Marooned on the river for 6 weeks while the damaged Endeavour was careened for safe passage through the Great Barrier Reef, the youthful Bank observed a bounding animal that outstripped his fleet greyhounds, a creature, he jotted in his journal, that instead of going upon all fours, went only upon two legs, making vast bounds. That's interesting that he took greyhounds. Banks was just, he used to skip on the deck, and he used to go out there, people would load the gun, he'd shoot birds, and they'd just get them. So he was just a real amazing person. I read his diaries. Really interesting to read his diaries alongside Cook's entries. There's nothing more amazing than that. Having enjoyed eating the flesh of this remarkable creature, he used to just shoot everything. Later, he and Captain Cook and his captain took the skin and skeleton of the kangaroo back to England. Banks' success in travelling as a travelling naturalist and his great assemblage of Australian Pacific natural history, which the expedition took back to England, propelled him to rapid fame and leadership in British science. Appointed director of the King's Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, he subsequently elected president, so he was actually a science tourist. In modern days, he paid for his passage, buckets of money to the Academy, paid for it, so like a space tourist with Elon Musk at the moment. He subsequently elected president of the prestigious Royal Society of London in 1778. At the age of 35, he created a baronet a few years later, and 40 years until his death, he set his entrepreneurial seal and patronage upon imperial science. In addition, Banks' recollections of vegetation near Sydney helped inspire his government's choice of Botany Bay for the establishment of a British penal settlement in 1788. Science followed the flag. What I would want to say is that he wanted to sell his book, so he just upmarketed Australia beyond what it was really worth. Resulting, there was a lively interest in anything antipodean, novelties the government's appointees and naval men might dispatch to England. The colony's first governor, Arthur Phillip, set the official ball rolling in 1791, which is 3 years after, by sending a live kangaroo to King George III, but the people's kangaroo had preceded it. Quote, the wonderful kangaroo from Botany Bay, the only one ever brought alive to Europe, a London Post declared excitedly in 1790. So it would soon be, quote, on exhibition in the Lyceum and Strand at 8 o'clock, in the morning until 8 o'clock in the evening. Quote, different from all quadrupeds, he explained. Let it suffice to observe that the indigenous are delighted and the connoisseur impressed with the wonder and astonishment at the unparalleled animal from the southern hemisphere. Queues crowd to pay and gape at the costly 1 shilling. Can I say that this sale mechanism was how William Damper, made its money. This is 100 years before Cook captured or took prisoner a tattooed native and displayed him for 1 shilling each. The kangaroo was 5 feet high, beautiful, amazing, enthralled Londoners. The great natural history popularizer Thomas Burke included the new animal in his general history of quadrupeds. But stranger findings would long appear from New South Wales. During 1798, Phillip's successor, Governor Hunter, a keen student of natural history, had watched an Aboriginal spearing a small amphibious animal of the mole kind, in a lake near the Hawkesbury River, close to Sydney. Hunter sent the animal's skin preserved in a keg of spirits with a wombat. That's the actual full name, to the Literary and Philosophical Society of Newcastle-upon-Tyne, which had recently honoured him with corresponding membership. The new creature, Hunter later told the anatomist Everett Holm, had fought for its life with such force that it caused its assailant with a spur. They have these poison spurs in the back of their legs. Its entry into scientific community was just as dramatic. The cast containing 2 specimens, way that historian says it's not necessarily true, reached Newcastle in late 1799, which was transported from the quayside to society's room by a woman servant. She carried it on her head. By mischance, the bottom of the cask gave way, dousing her with pungent spirits. But her dismay and horror was reportedly when looking down, she saw not only a small chunky wombat, but the remains of a strange creature, quote, strange creature, half bird, half beast, lying at her feet. The platypus had arrived in Britain. What a beautiful... I sort of love that. It's what I'm reading. You would have listened to me read read various people's reports or the forewords there, and they have a long paragraph and a short paragraph. The short paragraph is just a floater. It doesn't do anything. Here's a short paragraph. The platypus had arrived in Britain. Thomas Berwick himself, a citizen of Newcastle upon Tyne, aided Hunter's notes and drawings, introduced the platypus to the general public. The creature, he wrote in the 4th edition of his popular General History of Quadrupeds, 800, seems to be an animal sui genus, which means probably without, it appears to possess threefold nature, that of a fish, a bird, and a quadruped. That's right. The small amphibious animal of mole kind, and this is a picture. And there's more pictures here, I won't do the pictures. And it is related to nothing that we have hitherto seen. About the size of a small cat, its bill very similar to that of a duck. It has 4 short legs. The foreleg is shorter than those at the hind, and their webs spread considerably beyond the claws. This bear resisted, as he put it, any attempt to arrange it in any of the useful modes of classification, and his benign illustration of the odd little creature reflected none of the struggle that he had occasioned its transfer across the world. And also it's got electric sensors in its bill. I love it. Further specimens of the amphibious mole soon began arriving to whet the appetite. WHET, I didn't know you whet the appetite. WHET, I'll remember that. British and European naturalists, the eminent naturalist Sir George Shaw, securing a dried specimen during 1799 from an unnamed source in New South Wales, described the physical characteristics of the animal. The body resembling an otter in miniature. The head, flattish and rather small. The mouth, a snout exactly resembling some broad-billed species of duck. The tail, flat, furry, like the body. So we still call it the duck-billed platypus. The legs, very short, on the forefeet, 5 claws, straight, long, sharp and pointed. On the hind feet are 6 claws. Is that true? Okay, longer and more inclining curve form, the length of the whole animal is 13 inches. He published an illustration of the animal with his, and by his associate Frederick Nodler, together with drawing of its bill, fore and hind feet in his Natural Miscellany that year. First published interpretation of a platypus. Calling on his knowledge of Greek, Shaw bestowed the animal the name Platypus Antinus, from the Greek platypus, meaning flat-footed, and Antinus, meaning duck-like, Anatinus. But Shaw, an experienced naturalist at the so a platypus means flat-foot, a fellow of the Royal Society and assistant Kepler of the Natural History Museum, and assistant keeper of natural history at the British Museum, clearly regarded the peculiar system with suspicion. Could it, he wondered, be a hoax? Was he being deceived? Chinese and Japanese taxidermists were notorious for the skill for which they constructed non-existent animals, stitching a head and trunks of monkey onto the hind parts of a fish and selling it to incredulous sailors. Was it a colonial prank? Quote, of all the mammalia yet known, Shaw wrote in his account, it seems the most extraordinary in its conformation, exhibiting perfect resemblance of beak to a duck engrafted on the head of a quadruped. I almost doubted the testimony of my own eyes with respect to the structure of this animal's beak, he mused. And it was only with the most minute and rigid examination that he could persuade himself of it being a real beak and snout of a quadruped. But, he confessed, he could perceive no appearance of any deceptive preparation. This paradoxical quadruped, the renowned naturalist concluded wisely, must be left to future investigation. Yet mysteriously and clearly rattled, Shaw returned to the matter in 1800. By then, Joseph Banks had received from Governor Hunter 2 specimens preserved in spirits, and the reality of the Australian freak of nature was confirmed. It's interesting that Joseph Banks. With new confidence, Shaw reran the original description of the platypus in his General Zoology and declared it constituted a new and singular genus. 12,000 miles from platypus's habitat, he looked forward to more information from the observations from the colony of the natural history, and the animal so essentially different from all other quadrupeds. This new addition, he added, indeed confirmed a striking observation of the great French naturalist Buffon. Buffoon, that, quote, whatever was possible for nature to produce had actually been produced. Now, so much to see this platypus thing goes to any new product, any new innovation, which we haven't seen. Banks' scientific patron and promoter was now firmly in the act. Sitting at the head of British science, he had received 2 more specimens from Hunter, both of a platypus skin together with the beaks and bones. Of these, he sent 1 to Professor John Bulmanach of Europe's leading comparative anatomist. Bulmanach, based at the University of Göttingen, a foreign fellow of the Royal Society and a long correspondent with the Banks, had already got wind of that, quote, highly interesting novelty, brought over from Botany Bay, and begged for a specimen to depict in his German Natural History of Miscellany. The Albuldi Dungeon rewarded, he communicated with Banks in some excitement in March 1800, having given the new creature a scientific name of Ortinohorbihychus paradoxus. It needs not to tell you, he wrote, how exceedingly I must be surprised by the view of such a strange creature in the Ornithorhynchus paradoxus. for being under the necessity of christening, I thought it was a convenient name, taking the generic one from the most remarkable character of the bird-like beak, the nominative triviality from the quiet paradox shape. Blue March evidently lacked knowledge of Shaw's description. The wind of international science blew randomly and, for a period, a little animal's two turtles stood side by side. But it was found that Shaw's generic name, platypus, had been used in 1793 for a genus within the order of Calypta beetles and hence could not be sand. However, its apt classical derivation of flat-footed and platypus is a plural of platypuses, and its plural, platypuses, remains the animal popular moniker. So platypus is not its real name. Bulmich's generic designation passed into science, and in appropriate amalgamation, Stahl's species name, called Anitus, was added to the established, platyporus anatis. This means something which is duck-like on the zoological register, so the paradox got removed. In every way a paradox, the Australian arrival raised a host of questions. Was it, as the brown pelt suggested, a mammal? For possessing a covering of fur or hair, was it a defining characteristic of a mammalian class? Not breastfeeding. Okay. Or was it a reptile among the amphibian animals as it was grouped? Alternatively, its duck-like build indicated an affinity with the warm-blooded birds. Belmarch, puzzling, also remembered earlier writings about the griffin, a mythological beast in the body of a lion, wings and head of an eagle. Plainly no myth, the animal now confronting naturalists combines the distinctive parts of ant, mammal, reptile and bird. Clearly, Belmarch, Orthorhynchus, I wish I could say that, fitted none of the commonly recognized divisions demarking the major classes of vertebrates, the animals, fish, birds, reptiles, but... Oh God, this goes on. But as he outlined in a series of papers published in 1800, the German anatomist considered the animal conformed to the normal mammalian plan of organization. And while worried by its beak, he assumed that the female managed to suckle its young in some fashion with its duck bill. Blumich and Dr. Shaw enjoyed a peculiar advantage. Both had some knowledge of another of Australia's extraordinary fauna, the ant-eating porcupine, the echidna, which arrived in England from New South Wales some 7 years before the platypus. Shorts, how could that do? That's not technically possible. That's a puzzle. Shaw had described the animal with illustration by Nodder in July 1792. The 5 years later, the great French naturalist Georges Cuvier had placed the porcupine anteater with the mammalian order of Enidates, quadrupeds without incisive teeth, where it joined the anteater sloths and armadillos in the name Echidna hystrix. Now, this is interesting. Cuvier was a very famous person. I have to understand it. Captain Bligh, on the Bounty fame, had early recorded the echidna's presence when, on his second tour of duty in Australian waters, he put in at Bruny Island of Tasmania on 1792. Obviously, knocked about, a bit of an idiot. He noted in the logbook, one of his officers had killed an animal of a very odd form. It had no mouth like any other mammal, but a kind of duck bill which opens extremely extremity where it will not admit the size of a small pistol. Quills and prickles all over its back. It's really interesting that the little echidna is a bit unlike the hedgehog. It's got a little snout, poking snout. It's really interesting to look at. Bleiberg sent back a drawing of the eccentric creatures to his mentor's Bank, who doubtless had passed on to German correspondents. Banks, meanwhile, had directed the second of Hunter's dried platypus' specimens to the distinguished British astronomer Everett Home at the Royal College of Surgeons, London. Trained at the college under the legendary John Hunter, Home was also a fellow of the Royal Society and had and one of that breed of naturalists destined to establish a strong discipline of comparative anatomy in Britain. The study of the platypus could occupy him for many years. In his first paper on the animal in 1800, Home focused on the platypus's beak, and from the dry specimen at his disposal, it made it clear that despite the appearances to the contrary, the resemblance between that and that of a duck was essentially superficial. Oh no! Specimens of the elusive duck-billed mole, as the colonists continued to call it, now began to arrive in New South Wales, and their organs preserved and spirits giving eager anatomists access to the internal parts. Hunt's successor, Governor King, supplied Banks with a male and female. No pains of spirits, he wrote importantly, being spared to preserve them. Oh, pains of spirits. Oh. From this careful dissection of these prizes, Home was able to provide a full description of the animal's anatomy. At the same time, he enjoyed the advantage of the first-hand account of the platypus from Governor Hunter on his return from Australia in May 1801. So Hunter really didn't stay here very long. Hunter, a keen on-the-spot observer of Australian wildlife, had developed his own original ideas on the creation of the curious beast that seemed so various with the Northern Hemisphere's natural world. In his publication in early 1793, the handsome Hunter, I wonder why he suggested why he called it Hunter. He's called Handsome. Formosa, is it handsome Formosa means handsome. A promiscuous intercourse between different sexes of all different animals might account for this likely forms. This concept of random promiscuity unlikely to appeal to knowledgeable Home, but was shortly taken over by Charles Darwin's laughy grandfather, Dr. Emerus Darwin, and published to underpin, his theory of evolution developed from a single form, in the single form of zoonomia. That's interesting. For his part, Home concentrated his sound autonomous mind. Well, that's interesting. It shows how wacky all these scientists really were. mind the platypus beak and internal organs. In a series of papers written from 1800 to 1802, he found the beak was not part of the mouth, but rather an exploratory organ for touching, tasting, and served underwater in place of sight and smell. It's true, it's a little electromagnetic sensor. Its soft, fleshy edges function as scent organs and enable the animal to feel in the mud of the water, insects, and small crustaceans that comprise its food. In respect to the in the process of generation, Home noted the remarkable character of the reproductive organ of both female and male platypus, and finding that they were not comparable to those of other mammals, examined the corresponding parts of birds and reptiles and found the closest resemblance to the organs of an oviparous lizard, who produced their young by hatching them from an egg formed inside the mother's body. He went further. He determined that, again, like other quadrupeds, the female platypus possessed oviducts that opened in her excretory tract into a common chamber, the choa, rather than forming a uterus, so it's like a bird. The male also expelled urine from its choa from the opening at the base of its penis, reserving the penis for the passage of semen. That's interesting. So they do have a penis, but it's for only semen. These characteristics, Home summed up, distinguished the Ornithorhynchus in a very remarkable manner from all other quadrupeds, giving this a new tribe a resemblance in some respects to birds and others to amphibian, and so that it may be considered an intermediate link between the classes of mammalia. There was every reason to believe, he concluded, quote, that the animal is ovivalporous sick, that's actually in the mode of regeneration. But it was no straight run. Belmont, Shaw and Coolvier all judged the platypus to be a mammal, yet the apparent absence of nipples and mammary glands proved a stumbling block for Home. Traditional between bird, reptile and mammal, its first dissection was paradoxically platypus. The paradoxical platypus appeared to inhabit the zoological no man's land. The stage was set for conflict 5 years after discovery. It keeps on going. In Australia, three central questions about the platypus confronted the international fraternity of naturalists and anatomists. First was the First, what light did the strange mix of platypuses' anatomical features shed on the classical tree system, which naturalists had been designed to embrace the known fauna of the northern world? Second, how did the curious animal from the antipodes produce its young? If it was not viviparous, producing its young like other mammals, was it in truth oviparous, like some egg formed from the hatch within the female body, or was it perhaps oviparous, hatching its young young from eggs laid outside the body like a bird? So we actually have a little egg, and our eggs hatch 14 days after they're fertilized. The third most important was the relevance. Did this anomalous animal, drawn from its remote habitat, this misalliance of God's creatures, have the old ideas of perfectly ordered world of creation emergently from a medley of notorious notions about evolution that were beginning to stir in the geological circles in the 19th century dawned? As George Shaw had thoughtfully concluded when several Australian indigenous animals landed on his specimen table, the southern continent, quote, seemed to have been arranged according to a plan different from those that shaped the rest of the globe. One man who instantly seized upon the importance of the platypus was the young voyager turned scientific patron of the and diplomat Sir Joseph Banks. From his influential position, he corresponded with his colonial governors, issued instructions to His Majesty's ship's captains for collecting and preserving specimens, and spurred major maritime botanical adventures which opened up a widening knowledge of the scientific riches of the imperial regions of the world. During 1800, he, from his own private resources, sent George Cayley, a botanical collector from the Transit Queue, to Sydney, to begin a systematic collection of Australian plants. Amid growing interest, Banks was soon urging the diligent botanist to extend his skills to the observation of the platypus. Quote, "What I want to know," he wrote to Cayley in August 1802, "is the mode of generation of the duckbill and the porcupine anteater. Also specimens of both animals preserved in spirits, which should be once renewed after having stood for a month or two on the animal." Fired by Holmes' revelations, he repeated the request urgently the following year. Quote, "Our quests want here," he pressed early in April, "is to be acquainted with the manner in which the duckbill animal and the porcupine eater, which I think is of the same genus, breed. The internal structure is so very similar to that of birds, I do not think it's impossible that they could lay eggs, or at least, as snakes or some fish do, hatch eggs in their bodies." Cayley faced this new responsibility with customary application, moving out from his depot in Parramatta, some 30 kilometres from Sydney, in a widening arc. He was the earliest of the Australian naturalist collectors to cultivate the Aborigines, talking to them, heeding their words politely, and watching them hunt as they burned out kangaroos from the bush and caught them with spears. And now Cayley made strict inquiry amongst them and reported that, although he asked several, he could not receive any satisfactory answer. At length he learned from one man, quote, "What I think may be relied," he wrote to Banks in 1803, who told him that they went a long way underground and laid eggs. The natives, he recalled, called them two distinct names, viz. Bat and Malisling. Cayley himself admitted that the porcupine anteater was entirely unknown to him, and from that he learned from the natives is scarce. There's a few anteaters around here, echidnas around here. His inquiry clearly simulated the trade. Sellers charged what the market would bear. Cayley consequently bought his porcupine anteater from Aborigines at 5 gallons of rum. Banks was also activating other researchers. Robert Brown, of Brown in Motion, whom he had personally chosen with Matthew Flinders. So this is Robert Brown of Brown in Motion. There you go. Good Aussie person, good Brownian motion. Botanist of the Exhibition of Australian Circumnavigation of the HMS Investigator in 1901 to 1904, and a record of the flora of the new land was the press for help. Quote, I have not yet had an opportunity of dissecting a female Orthohoryschios, Brown responded from New South Wales in August 1903, although a fellow officer had, quote, found the urethra of a male to determine in the anus, a fact which had Brown thought Banks was probably acquainted, and which indeed might almost be inferred from the double-headed penis. A month later, confronted with a female platypus specimen that was unimpregnated and not quite fresh, Brown told his mentor that he had nothing to add to your letter, in respecting the organs of generation, except that I found a fallopian tube completely impervious at the other junction and their junction with the vagina. The botanist's data on the male and female platypus confirmed the dissections of home. The investigator expedition, this is with Brown, it's really interesting about the investigator expedition, also captured a special record. The ship's botanical artist, Australian-born Ferdinand Boyd, the investigator was a junk, a lemon of a ship. The botanical artist, Australian-born Ferdinand Boyd, described as the Leonardo of natural history painting, carefully made a life-size pencil drawing of two platypus. This is observed in New South Wales, sketching them in full and noting their colours against a coded chart of complex hues that he carried with him on the journey so that he could complete illustrations on his return to England. His depiction of animals with their stout tails, strong beaks, was the first drawing of a live animal since Hunter's rudimentary sketch, and it lay hidden and published by the artist. Oh, come on. In the British Museum of Natural History, until it was unveiled to the public viewing among Bayer's remarkable floral and natural history drawings in the second last decade of the 20th century. Wow. So, he did lots of things that was hidden for all that time. Meanwhile, in Australia, in the eastern rivers and creeks of the huge continents stretching from New Zealand down to New South Wales and Victoria, across the Pacific and Tasmania, the platypus itself, untroubled, drifted quietly down the streams. It appeared at sunset, creature of crepuscular habits, secluded entirely noiselessly in diving appearance in search of food, and making its home in concealed burrows along the riverbank. I must admit, beavers are incredibly noisy. I camped in Canada all through the night ago. Well, firstly, heaps of mosquitoes in Canada, but also, and of course the mosquitoes all died. I had put on Australian insect repellent, and the mosquitoes weren't used to it, didn't repel them, they just landed on mosquito repellent and died. So I put on my Australian insect repellent, and all these mosquitoes just landed on me and died. I was festooned with these black, writhing corpses on me. It's unlike them. So it was a tropical insect repellent. But all through the night, the beavers got whack, back. So the beaver tail would use to whack at the noise. On seeing them, one early colonist noted, the spectator must remain perfectly stationary, as the slightest movement will cause the timid creature instantly to disappear. So acute is their insight or hearing. Wary of reticent, they are very difficult to catch, and specimens of the Orthohoryschios antis are a rarity in the first decades of Australian settlement. Yet, while direct knowledge of the platypus moved at a snail's pace in the colonies, a burst of theoretical investigation erupted in Europe. Following Bull March and the flamboyant French naturalist savant, Etienne Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire entered the scene. In 1803, working on Holmes' and notable observations on both the platypus and echidna, he coined the term monotreme, which is what we use today, in place of two animals, a new class of monotremia. Monotreme, it literally means one hole. This was based on the knowledge that the single clacal chamber at the anatomical feature of both animals. A long struggle to give a taxonomic definition and proposition to the Elasis platypus had begun. Oh, I thought it had ended.
podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.